You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 10th of October 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I am Markus Hippi. Coming up on today's show, from Turkey to Oslo, Pyongyang to the UK, I'll be joined by Jane Kinnaman and Jim Hoare for a rundown of the day's top news. Also coming up. Radio. Author Grail Marcus will be here to discuss his new book, The History of Rock and Roll in 10 Songs, and later in the show.
Father Price, could you tell me what that means?
It's a prayer of resurrection. This prayer has been lost for 1,500 years.
I think somebody may have found it.
We'll talk cinema with film critic Karen Krizanovic. All that plus much more to come right here on Midori House with me, Markus Hippi. So lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House. But before all that, here is Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news.
Hospital staff have staged a noisy protest at Madrid's Carlos Tres Hospital today as the Spanish Prime Minister, Mariano Rajoy, made an impromptu visit. Rajoy was visiting the facility where the nurse Teresa Romero is lying gravely ill after contracting the Ebola virus. Recriminations have mounted over how the Spanish nurse became infected despite strict protocols for handling contagious patients. She was infected in the high security section of the hospital but remained undiagnosed for days despite reporting her symptoms. And Brazilian health officials say a man suspected of being infected with Ebola is in good shape and that laboratory tests should confirm if he has the deadly virus within 24 hours. Meanwhile, a World Bank economist, David Evans, has said that the regional impact of West Africa's Ebola epidemic could reach $32.6 billion by the end of 2015 if it spreads significantly beyond the worst-hit countries of Guinea, Liberia and Sierra Leone.
The economic impact of this crisis in the three most affected countries, Guinea, Liberia and Sierra Leone, is already very serious from what we see on the ground. If the crisis isn't brought under control in the next few months, we predict much larger economic impacts, upwards of $30 billion by the end of 2015.
Already, the virus is having an impact on business. Travel agents like agent Pat Conodo say they are already feeling the effect of the Ebola scare.
At the moment, we haven't got passengers traveling to Freetown at all. Because of the Ebola situation, they all come for their money. Those going for Christmas holidays, they all come back for their deposits. So nothing is going, nothing is coming.
Other news now. A United Nations envoy called on Turkey today to help prevent a slaughter in the Syrian border town of Kobani at the hands of Islamic State fighters, saying he feared a repeat of the 1995 Srebrenica massacre when thousands died. Stéphane de Mistura, the UN's envoy to Syria, appealed to Ankara to let volunteers cross the frontier so that they can reinforce Kurdish militias defending the town that lies within sight of Turkish territory. Ireland is set to announce legal changes next week to phase out the so-called double Irish tax arrangement that has let firms such as Google save billions of dollars, two sources familiar with the matter have said. Ireland has come under sustained attack from Europe and the United States over the past 18 months for its tax rules that allow multinational companies such as Google and Apple to cut their overseas tax rates to single digits. The Pakistani teenager Malala Yousafzai, shot in the head by the Taliban 2 years ago for advocating girls' rights to education, and the Indian children's right advocate Kailash Satyarthi have won the 2014 Nobel Peace Prize. The Nobel Committee chairman, Torbjørn Jagland, said Satyarthi had maintained Gandhi's tradition, showing great courage in his peaceful protests against the exploitation of children, and he had this to say about Malala Yousafzai.
Despite her youth, Malala Yousafzai has already fought for several years for the right of girls to education and has shown by example that children and young people too can contribute to improving their own situations. This she has done under the most dangerous circumstances. Through her heroic struggle, she has become a leading spokesperson for girls' rights to education.
And finally, some news in brief. Thailand's traffic police will get extra money in return for refusing bribes, police have said, as part of the junta's efforts to combat what it has called the ingrained culture of corruption within the force. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. And Jonathan will be back with more news headlines in about 25 minutes. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and we are back right after this.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Uit London, това е Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.06 and it is 13.06 in New York City. Joining me in the studio with their take on the news is Jane Kinnamont, Senior Research Fellow and Deputy Head of the Middle East and North Africa Programme at Chatham House, and Jim Hoare from SOAS, a Korean affairs expert and a former British diplomat in Pyongyang. Welcome both to the programme.
Thank you.
According to the latest news, up to 700 people, most elderly, are still trapped in the Syrian border town of Kobani. Kobani has been a major battleground for IS and the Kurds for 3 weeks already. At the same time, Turkey says it won't send ground troops to Syria despite increasing public pressure. Instead, Turkey has been calling for the creation of a no-fly zone over its border with Syria. Jane, if I start with you, when you look at the situation of the people still left in Kobani, it doesn't look very promising, does it?
No, this has been an extremely brutal conflict, so it's going to be a terrifying place. There's a high risk that the border will be sort of cut off completely, and you know, people there, I think, are very afraid.
And Jim, what is your impression of this situation? Indeed, there is a lot of pressure for Turkey to do something in this situation, but it seems that Turkey is very reluctant. Can we actually expect much from that country?
Insofar as I understand it, it doesn't look as though Turkey wants to become involved in any sort of land conflict. It has a particular take on an air conflict. But the complication is, of course, the domestic Turkish-Kurdish community and the implications for that. So I can see that the rest of the world is going to say, oh, Turkey should do something. But equally, I can see Turkey not doing anything. Mm.
Well, Turkey's reluctance to act in Syria seems to be partly due to concerns about arming Kurdish forces. Do you think there is a lot other stuff going on in the background as well?
Yes, absolutely. I think Turkey's policy has actually been very consistent, which is that it has vehemently opposed the government of Bashar Assad since about August 2011. And so currently it's saying that it doesn't want to get involved unless there might be a broader offensive against Bashar Assad. But even though politically they have wanted him to be removed, the Turkish military has been all along against getting sucked in on the ground because they fear that they might not have an exit strategy.
But at the same time, looking at the situation when it comes to fighting against the IS, there are US-led airstrikes, and at the same time there is Free Syrian Army, the Iraqi army, and of course the Kurds fighting against as well.
It's a very complex situation, but ultimately the US airstrikes are probably of limited utility. We had a meeting this week at Chatham House with a very credible analyst from the region who was saying, looking at these airstrikes up close from the region, you realise it is simply a pyrotechnic display aimed at Western audiences. This is something of symbolic value, but the Islamic State has generally been disappearing from areas where there are airstrikes and then going back in when the airstrikes stop.
Jim, do you agree with that? Have the airstrikes actually
There is a delusion. There is a delusion that you can solve a problem on the ground by using aircraft. There's a delusion that you can bomb or strafe people into accepting. It didn't work in the Second World War, although the myth is still there. It I've just finished reading Richard Overy's book on the bombing war, which is very sobering when you come to it. You run the risk in all such situations of actually killing the people you're supposed to be helping. And as Jane says, that the people you're attacking can actually just drift away from the attacks, away from the airstrikes. So it doesn't actually solve the problem.
What do you think? How long will we actually see these airstrikes, and how long will the situation remain like this?
Well, the exit strategy for the Western and Middle Eastern coalition is not obvious either, because it's unlikely that the airstrikes are going to be able to comprehensively defeat the Islamic State. So at what point can you declare mission accomplished and have anything credible going on? What's really missing here in Syria is any diplomatic process. The UN peace talks that we saw in Geneva just completely petered out. We have a new UN envoy to Syria in place, but right now there is no diplomatic plan to actually try and bring about even a truce in Syria, let alone try to resolve the civil war there. And that is what it's going to take, a broader political solution that brings in the various countries in the region who are sponsoring different sides of the civil war.
And who should do that incentive to start that kind of process?
Well, anybody can, but nobody seems to want to. That seems to be the problem.
I think the onus still is on the UN to play that role, because although everyone will criticise the UN, it is still the most kind of neutral of the powers. It's a country that can have dialogue with everybody concerned. But of course, one of the blockages is that Russia and the US have a lot of issues between them, most of all Ukraine, and so they haven't shown much desire to talk to each other over Syria. You have seen Iran and Saudi Arabia recently holding talks because both of them are quite afraid of the Islamic State. That could be a very important dynamic. They've been backing opposing sides in Syria, but if they can come to see a common threat to the region, maybe they could cooperate.
How much could they do together?
Ultimately, Iran is the country with the greatest influence over the Assad regime. Saudi Arabia has a lot of traction with some of the armed groups, especially other Islamist groups. And the Gulf states are major players in backing the Syrian opposition with money. So peace talks can't work without them.
And something we've got from Turkey is a suggestion of creating a no-fly zone in the border region. Jane, how well have you understood how this would actually work and how it would benefit the situation?
This is something the Turks have been calling for a long time, and the Syrian National Coalition has been calling for it since about 2011. The idea being essentially that you would create a safe haven where the armed opposition would continue to operate and would be able to use it as a base to attack Assad. So it would be something that would help the balance against Assad, but it doesn't seem to have caught up with the new reality of the Islamic State, who could even benefit from a no-fly zone.
And if Turkey doesn't take action to help these Kurds trapped in Kobani, do you think this could end up ruining any chance of any peace with the Kurds in Turkey?
I don't really know enough about it to be able to give an opinion, but it doesn't, I think, it's not going to make it any easier for the Turkish government to settle the domestic issue of its own Kurds.
We could say that if they did help, it would be an opportunity. I mean, the Kurds historically have actually been quite divided between the different countries, so not helping the Kurds in one country wouldn't necessarily totally prevent progress with the PKK in Turkey if you were giving the PKK and the Kurds in Turkey more rights, but it would help if more was done.
Well, let's continue now with other news about the Nobel Peace Prize. It was announced that the winner of this year's Peace Prize goes actually to two recipients, Pakistani child education activist Malala Yousafzai and Indian child rights campaigner Kailash Satyarthi. Jim, did these award prizes go to the right addresses?
Oh, there's a difficult question. I think actually they are imaginative awards. I think that the Nobel Peace Prize has not always gone where you might have expected to. As Tom Lehrer said, when Henry Kissinger got the prize, that was the end of satire. And there's been a lot of doubt over some of the people selected over the years for the Peace Prize. And it's been sometimes a very diversive thing rather than bringing people together. I mean, back in 2000, Kim Dae-jung of South Korea was given it for bringing peace on the peninsula, but the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-il, wasn't given it, and yet they both had worked for the end. Now, peace hasn't yet reached the Korean peninsula, but that was a missed opportunity, I suspect, because I think if Kim Jong-il had been given it, it would have made a huge difference. This one, as I say, I think this is imaginative, it's different, it's hard to be very critical of it, though I did see that on the BBC webpage that there were some people saying, what's this young woman done, apart from getting shot, and somebody saying, I was shot, why don't I get the Peace Prize? But I think she has made an impact. And if you think of this prize as particularly a symbol of what we hope for, then I think it's probably a good choice.
Jane, what are your thoughts?
It's a symbolic prize. At the end of the day, it's meant to be highlighting the crucial importance of education in peace building, and I think that does have some value, and it is far less ridiculous than giving it to Barack Obama, you know, essentially because he wasn't George Bush.
And even before he'd done anything.
Yes.
So, no, I think this is a positive sign.
Do you think these kind of examples of Peace Prize possibly not gone that right have affected how much people actually respect this prize?
I mean, it's curious that this prize, devised by a council of Scandinavian elders and bureaucrats, actually has the international profile that it does. And I think that's because in many years they have chosen people who have resonated with the wider world, although also it's sometimes been odd choices, and sometimes it's gone to UN agencies or charities, which have been less easy for people to identify with because they don't have a personal face.
I don't know how much, in fact, impact it makes anyway. I mean, it'll be covered in the newspapers for a day or so, and then it will fade. I can name some of the winners. I've only met one, and that was Aung San Suu Kyi. But I met Kim Dae-jung as well, come to think of it. So I've met two of them. But most people, it doesn't sort of impinge on their lives, I think, very much at all.
Can you think of any examples when Nobel Peace Prize actually would have made a difference, when it would have had some sort of implications?
I think these sorts of awards can give individuals protection and status, you know, maybe in the case of Aung San Suu Kyi, someone who is internationally decorated and not by the US, not by the UK, but from a country that is seen as a little bit more neutral in international affairs, then I think it can make dictators think twice about what they do to them.
That's certainly true of the Nobel Prize for Literature, and moving on
from
the Peace Prize. It's ironic in a way, I suppose, that the Peace Prize comes from a fund that was set up by a dynamite manufacturer.
Yes.
So it's always had a strange
irony
about it, indeed.
Let's continue with a short break now. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. I'll be back with Jane Kinnamond and Jim Hall right after this.
Should cities ban the car? Can we make truly sustainable metropolises? What happens if neighbourhoods lose their corner shops? How do you put a stop to suburban decay? Do children belong in big bad capitals? Can Detroit be saved? Can Sydney become a cycle capital? Can we learn to love concrete? And are rich cities always boring? If you want the answers to the big questions facing our cities, you need to tune in to The Urbanist, Monocle 24 Radio's weekly show about the cities we live in. Expect global reports, great interviews, passionate debate, and some surprises too, because drag star taxi drivers, love motel owners, and retail rebels also get their say. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 hours London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
The morning show for North America's East Coast is a pacey roundup of the day's main stories. The briefing features informed news reporting, prescient business analysis, and invaluable industry reports from all around the world.
the protesters on the street are doing all of this in order to try and get the military to take over and to declare an emergency and basically start something that looks like a coup in order to get the current government out of power.
Each day we're joined by an expert. Monocle's correspondents and industry insiders are in studio for analysis of the aviation, technology, defence, media and luxury retail sectors. Our friends at Bloomberg and Reuters in London and New York make sense of the latest markets, business and economic data.
I try to avoid the term perfect storm, but it applies so well here that I can't avoid using it.
They have a lot of difficulties to actually bring the two parties together. And on top of that, in recent weeks, we are witnessing infighting between rebels themselves in northern Syria. So there are a lot of different clashes within this.
And of course, a Monocle editor drops into the studio to review the papers across North and South America. That's a briefing every weekday at noon London time, 7 a.m. East Coast, here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It is 21:21 in Moscow, 18:21 here in London, and 10:21 in San Francisco. Still with me is Jane Kinnaman from Chatham House and Korean expert Jim Ho from SOAS. North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un has now been away from the public eye for over a month. He was last seen on the 3rd of September, which makes this his longest absence from the public view so far. Today, Kim missed an important anniversary, which is the 69th anniversary of the Workers' Party. Jim, you being the Korea expert, any ideas on where Kim could be?
Well, it's a difficult question because one of the great problems we have dealing with North Korea is that we know much more about North Korea than we used to. There's a lot of information now through the UN, through the NGOs, through diplomatic relations. What we don't have is information on the inner workings of the regime, of the party, the government, and the military. And certainly, this comes down to the real inner workings of the whole thing. The signs are that although Kim clearly has some problem, that it doesn't look like, to me anyway, at this stage, any sort of political problem. There's no sign of briefings going on. We do hear about those briefings going on in the countryside, away from the big cities, about a change. There's no sign of military preparations, which, if there was some sort of coup, you'd expect. So we have to come back to what the regime has told us, which is that he's not well. We know he was limping. And I think there's a lot of exaggeration about the various things he's missed. Yes, he has missed some things, but it's certainly in his father's and grandfather's day that the supreme leader, the top dog, only appeared at certain anniversaries, and he didn't necessarily appear at all of them. So the 70th would have been important. The 69th is perhaps not quite so important.
I was just going to ask about the significance of this anniversary today, because it's been emphasised how important that is. But obviously, the 70th would be more important than the 69th.
Yeah, that's right. Every 5 and every 10 is marked, usually in a big way. And certainly with Kim Jong-il, you could never be sure that he wouldn't turn up, except on those occasions. So the evidence is not clear at all.
Well, other countries are very much wondering about the absence of Kim Jong-un, but do you think North Korean citizens are wondering about this themselves? Or do they even know that he hasn't been in public?
You've touched on a difficulty. I suspect most people don't really know. That those in Pyongyang may know, and they need to be briefed, but outside there, I doubt it. My staff, in the embassy, didn't know whether Kim Jong-il was married. I mean, the father of Kim Jong-un. They asked me, was he married? Did he have children? Those sort of things were not made public. So the disappearance of a leader, he hasn't disappeared from television, of course. He's still being shown on television. Old newsreels, old visits and so on, as is his father and grandfather still. So ordinary people, I should think, are not yet worried about what's going on.
It's been speculated somewhere that potentially he would be challenged, deposed. If this was the case, you said already that there are no signs of that, but what would those signs be like?
Well, I would expect some hint of it would come out through the briefings that are normally carried out throughout the country. I mean, my staff had to go every evening for a briefing session, a debriefing session about what they'd been doing, but also briefing about what they should be thinking and what they should be saying to me. So that applies throughout the country, as it used to do in China and in the Soviet Union to a lesser extent, I think. So there'd be hints coming from that. We're not getting that. I think that if there was some sort of coup going on, you might start seeing the military moving. There'd be no signs of that. The South Koreans and the Americans who monitor these things closely have reported no unusual military movements. And then a team went to the Asian Games and a senior delegation went for the end of the Asian Games. That again points more to normality than it does to a problem.
Let's finish by talking about the anti-EU UKIP party, or UK Independence Party, which has won its first elected seat in Parliament today by a very large margin, that indeed in the UK. All this week on Monocle 24 we have been looking at far-right parties across Europe, and I'd like to ask, do either of you see this trend as a lasting one, or are we seeing a momentary state of affairs? Or is this indeed a more worrying long-term one? Jane?
I think it's part of a broader anti-establishment trend across the world, a reaction against political elites that are identified with the 1% and so forth, and a feeling that democracy has been compromised by globalisation. I think the strength of support for Scottish independence by historical standards was part of the same issue. You might even perhaps rather glibly say that the Islamic State is reflecting a similar trend. It's more a frustration with the status quo than necessarily a conviction that this new alternative will definitely be better.
But Jim, what do you think? Will this frustration go away at some point? Will this rise of right-wing movements actually end one day?
I think the British case is a bit different from some of the European ones. I mean, the Mr. Farage's party is nowhere like the National Front in France, for example, which is well-established now and does have a strong parliamentary presence. I think one MP who used to be a Conservative until a few weeks ago is not really the deluge that you might expect. But I agree that this is part of frustration with current politics. But it's too early, I think, to say whether this is really going to be a new pattern in British politics. People do vote differently at by-elections from how they vote at general elections. Now, maybe that's changing, but I think I'd need a bit more evidence before I would say Mr. Farage is the future.
How much do you think the media is going to play in this? Not being from this country myself, I'm amazed by how every day when I read newspapers, I just come across that face. Mr. Farage is there.
Well, it's partly because it's a sort of amusing face, perhaps, should we say, for want of anything. And he appears making funny faces even on top of his normal expression. So I think he's a gift to the media. But
he has entertainment value, much like Boris Johnson. And again, it reflects the fact that so many politicians are too well-managed. They all sound the same. They're too kind of wary of losing support and alienating people to actually say anything substantive. So when you get somebody that's willing to be a bit more sort of cheeky, then they will get airtime.
And he can only be that when he's not anywhere near power, really.
Very
because
true.
Once they really were coming close to power, they would have to start having real policies instead of a pint in the pub, which seems to be the main policy.
So do you think that if they actually get more power, that is going to mark the end for this rise?
I think that, there's a year, just under a year to the general election. I would be surprised if at the general election the party actually had more than a handful of seats. If it got five, that would be a lot, and that isn't going to make much difference.
That's what did for the BNP. So it depends whether UKIP could be smarter and more united, but they do have, I think, more of a handful of interesting personalities than a real strategy.
We have to leave it there already. Jane Kinnaman from Chatham House and Jim Hoare from SOAS, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Midori House. Thank you.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио, Monocle 24 です.
Лондино, Нью Йорк, Токио.
This is Monocle 24.
There is plenty more to come on the second half of today's edition of Midori House. We'll check in with our man in Budapest. We'll survey the history of rock and roll in 10 songs. And it is cinema time with Karin Krisanovic as well. But before we get started on that, here is Jonathan Wheatley with the World News Headlines.
Thank you very much. Hospital staff have staged a noisy protest at a Madrid hospital today as the Spanish Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy made an impromptu visit. He was visiting the facility where the nurse Teresa Romero is lying gravely ill after contracting the Ebola virus. A United Nations envoy has called on Turkey today to help prevent a slaughter in the Syrian border town of Kobani at the hands of Islamic State fighters. Stefan de Mistura, envoy to Syria, said he feared a repeat of the 1995 Srebrenica massacre when thousands died. Ireland is set to announce legal changes next week to phase out the so-called double Irish tax arrangement that has let firms such as Google save billions of dollars, two sources familiar with the matter have said. And the Pakistani teenager Malala Yousafzai, shot in the head by the Taliban 2 years ago for advocating girls' right to education, and an Indian children's rights advocate have both won the 2014 Nobel Peace Prize. And that's latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan Wheatley. And welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. The time is 21:31 in Moscow, 18:31 here in London, and 14:31 in Rio de Janeiro. It is time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. And today we head to Hungary, where our man in Budapest, Adam Labor, is waiting. Adam, how are you doing over there?
I'm doing very well, thank you. Yeah, thanks for having me on the programme.
Thank you very much for joining the programme. First of all, local elections are taking place this weekend. What does it look like at the moment? There's been some predictions already.
Yes, it looks like the governing party, the ruling right-wing Fidesz party, will win another landslide. Most polls are giving them sort of around between 40 and 50% of the vote. The left is fractured into four or five different parties, and the main opposition seems to be the far right.
And indeed, talking about the far right, it's been predicted somewhere that a party may even win one relatively large city in the east. Is that really so?
Yes, Miskolc, which is either the third or the fourth largest city in this country, depending on how you kind of quantify it. The vote split three ways between the left and the Fidesz, the governing party, and Jobbik. And there are some indications that Jobbik might actually win, which would give them a very serious power base, because they already have some mayorships in small towns and small villages, but they don't count for much. But if you take one of the big four or five cities in the country, then you really start to get serious.
How has the rise of the far right been explained in Hungary? What is in the backdrop?
Well, one reason is that neither the governing party nor the left wing, the sort of very fractured left, has dealt with a lot of issues that are affecting a lot of people. I mean, there's, for example, loads of statistics say something between 35, maybe even up to 40% of people are living on the poverty or the subsistence line, which is really just a few hundred dollars a month. That, you know, tens of thousands of children are going to sleep hungry. They don't have access to a proper bathroom. You know, that once you get it, you know, if you come and visit Budapest, you think it is a beautiful modern city. But once you get out into the countryside, especially in the east of the country, there's serious deprivation. And there's also the big, you know, question which many people are unprepared to discuss in forthright terms, which is the situation of the Gypsy or the Roma minority, which hasn't really altered at all over the last 20 years. And, you know, today I was speaking to someone from the government about that, and they were saying that this is a problem that's been for 600 years. But nonetheless, none of the governing parties have really taken you know, have a proper plan to deal with that. Many Roma kids are segregated, sort of wrongly classified as mentally handicapped when they're not, and leave school at 12 or 14 and become essentially unemployable and go into a live a welfare culture life. And it just seems to go on and on and on. And that's also contributing to the rise of the far right.
So if we take this large city in the east as an example, Miskolc, if I pronounce the name right, what kind of a place is it?
Well, Miskolc is a big city. It has some foreign investment. It's a place where, you know, it's a kind of important city in the country, together with Szeged in the south, and Debrecen is another big city in the east. It was formerly a big base for the socialists. It was traditionally a kind of left-wing area, but the left has, you know, proved incredibly incompetent. I mean, there are places where they're not even putting up candidates, and the Socialist Party has virtually collapsed. It's split into three different factions, which spend most of their time arguing with each other. And over, I mean, I think everyone realizes that the left is going to have to unite at some stage, but that's just simply not happening. But I mean, Miskolc is a place with potential. It's near the Slovak border. It's near the Ukrainian border. It's not all a place of social deprivation, but there is a feeling there that, you know, that the far right is the one with the dynamism and the energy and the organization.
Well, Adam, moving forward, there's an interesting headline in the local press. A top U.S. embassy official has said that civil society in Hungary is under intimidation. What's going on over there?
Well, there's a big row going on with some NGOs that distribute money from Norway. Norway, Iceland and Liechtenstein have a program where they give money to NGOs in Hungary. And the row is over whether or not the Hungarian government has a right to kind of know or monitor how that money is being distributed or have any say in it. Now, the NGOs say that there's an agreement between Hungary and Norway that the money will be distributed from Brussels to an organization in Hungary which will deal with it. And now the Hungarian government is saying, you are NGOs in Hungary, you are subject to Hungarian law. And some of these NGOs have been raided by the police. The police have even raided, raided the house and the flat, taken away the laptop, of the personal laptop of one of the heads of these NGOs, which has caused a huge kerfuffle. And the Norwegian EU minister wrote a letter to the Financial Times saying there should be sanctions against Hungary, and Hungary is saying this is just ridiculous. You know, the government is saying it's ridiculous because these NGOs are in Hungary and any organization in Hungary is subject to Hungarian law. So there's a big standoff.
And finally, something a bit lighter in Budapest, thermal baths are even to be upgraded.
Yes, yeah. I mean, Budapest has a lot of hot springs, has the most wonderful thermal baths, and some of them date right back to the Turkish era. The best one is called the Mudash, which is on the Danube, and it's in a place where they have raves and parties now as well. And that's been renovated, but there's lots of others which are a bit more run down, and they're going to pump an awful lot of money into doing them up and making them much more of a tourist attraction. And they really are an amazing experience because these are the kind of the Turkish baths that used to be all over southern Europe. Remember, Hungary used to be part of the Ottoman Empire. And it seems that Hungary is the only place where they still exist. You know, there's none in Serbia or Bulgaria or Bosnia, which were the other bits of the Ottoman Empire. And the government seems to really realize that this is a real national treasure, and they're doing them up very nicely, and a lot more money is going to flow towards them.
I was just going to ask about that, because when I was reading about one article, it says that indeed these bathhouses are to be modernized, which kind of sounds a bit suspicious sometimes, considering about how much the history is respected and so forth. But they're going to be beautifully done, right?
Well, yes. I mean, the Rudash, which is really a jewel of Ottoman architecture, has been done brilliantly. I'm a regular there, and we were all really quite impressed with it. They've sort of dug out bits of the Ottoman wall and highlighted them with nice kind of moody lighting and little plaques explaining what was built when and showing the original, you know, bits of the original pipes from 500 years ago. And they've really made a real effort to kind of conserve it and keep the atmosphere, but sort of make it a bit more comfortable. It was rather ramshackle and grimy before. So they can get it right here, and they have got it right.
I'm glad to hear that. Was Adam Labor in Budapest. Thank you very much. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Up next, we'll survey the history of rock and roll in 10 songs.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
Spirit, love, energy, and culture. To be quickly accessible, unreroute the river, let the damned water be. There's some people down the way that's thirsty, so let the liquid spirit free.
The weekly culture show on Monocle 24 is where you get your art kicks. Just recently, we've welcomed Tracy Emin, Damien Hirst, and Anish Kapoor to the show. Culture is where you get your musical licks. Just the other day, Gregory Porter, Casey Musgraves, and Diane Birch entertained our airwaves. They come round here, then go get their Grammys. Culture is your antidote to everyday arts coverage, featuring reports and interviews from everywhere you didn't know you wanted to get to know, in books, art, music, media, film, and everything from around the world beamed right between your ears. Culture premieres every Monday at 1900 London time, and why not visit monocle.com and iTunes for the archive of over 140 shows. Swing by and hear Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Markus Hippi. It is quite a job to try to choose 10 songs that would encapsulate the history of rock and roll. However, my next guest has bravely attempted this, and his book, The History of Rock and Roll in 10 Songs, is out now. Grille Marcus, welcome to Midori House.
It's great to be with you.
Why did you choose to come up with a book like this?
I was asked to write a history of rock and roll. And I said, I can't think of anything more boring. It's been done to death. Everybody knows what the history of rock and roll is, or anyway, what it's supposed to be. Who would want to tell that story again? So I said, no. But I kept thinking about it, and I thought, well, what if you told this history in a way that wasn't chronological, that had nothing to do with development or sophistication, that wasn't about where you left out all the people you absolutely can't leave out, where you didn't talk about any of the great historical events that you're supposed to talk about. And you just wrote about a small number of songs, I didn't know how many, that would capture everything the music ever wanted to be and everything it was.
Was it hard to choose those 10 songs?
No. Once I came up with that idea, I knew instantly the first song I would write about would be the Flamin' Groovies' Shake Some Action.
By the way, before you continue, let's listen to a clip of that.
Let's do that.
Shake Some Action by Flamin' Groovies. So you were just about to tell why you decided to choose this song to be included in this book.
As long as I've heard that song, it came out in 1976, heard it on the radio, played it for myself, and I can never play it without playing it at least 3 times. I think to myself, this is everything rock and roll ever wanted to be. This is it. This is a definition. I don't think they set out to write the song to define anything. They aren't a dictionary. But it always played that way for me. And I also knew that the next song I would write about would be Joy Division's Transmission, because I don't know any piece of music that is as extreme, that is more over the edge, that feels more dangerous than Ian Curtis and Joy Division in that song. And I thought that would be hard to write about, hard to tackle that, and I couldn't wait to try. The rest kind of fell into place. The rest announced themselves.
Well, let's listen to another audio clip, song clip. This is In the Still of the Night by the Five Satins. Grille, I do like your picks for this book. This was the Five Satins with In the Still of the Night. Why is this song significant?
You know, I've always loved it. It's a beautiful record. Made one day in New Haven, Connecticut in 1956 in a church basement. And it's always been the most loved doo-wop song. And again, as a writer, the challenge of getting to, well, what makes this record so special? What makes it so different? And I listened and I listened and I let the song pull itself apart and put itself back together. And I realized that what's going on has to do with the way the piano breaks up the lyrics, the way the backing singers take the song away from the lead singer, a kind of tension, a desire, a wish that is established in the song that is never, ever going to be satisfied, that's never going to be realized. And there, that sense of loss and pain, along with the very conventional "I love you, you love me" lyrics, creates a kind of mystery that is never going to be solved. And yet you keep coming back to the song, and you play it, and you play it, and David Cronenberg plays it in Dead Ringers, and it just appears in so many situations because people can't let go of it. And I've never been able to let go of it.
Greil, we have one more song. This is "To Know Him Is to Love Him" by Amy Winehouse.
No, him.
What a voice, Amy Winehouse, oh, there,
that,
indeed.
That just kills me. Oh, what a tragedy. That's a song from 1958. It was a corny doo-wop song, Phil Spector's first record with his high school trio. And it took 50 years for that song to find its singer. And it did. And Amy Winehouse unlocked that song. She found pathos. She found wish. She found longing. She found hurt. And she found satisfaction that that song had never revealed to anybody. And she reached maybe her highest moment, sitting in a radio station in London, singing that song just as we heard it.
Greil, do we realize when a great song comes out how great it is? So are these one of those things when you only realize greatness later on?
You know, I think we do. Shake Some Action was supposed to be the Flamin' Groovies' big hit, and it wasn't a hit. It didn't make the charts. It disappeared. But it found its listeners, and the people who heard it when it first came out loved it, and they love it still. It just wasn't that many people. So I think people recognized from the first that "In the Still of the Night" was something special. Peter Hook of Joy Division talks about a time when they were playing Transmission at a rehearsal, and I'm not sure if they'd ever played it on stage before, but just during the rehearsal, and there were some people around in the hall where they were going to be playing later that night, everybody stopped. Everybody stopped cold, and Peter Hook said, "I realized then this was our first great song." They had broken through into their own music. So in that moment, those people on that floor recognized that this was something they'd never heard before.
And we're going to hear that song now. Thank you very much for this interview, Greil Marcus, author of The History of Rock and Roll in 10 Songs.
Thanks for having me.
The book is out now, and this is indeed the song we were talking about, Joy Division with Transmission. That was music by Joy Division. Transmission was the name of the track. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And finally on the show, it's time for our daily arts review. And today we talk film critic Karen Krizanovic joins me now in the studio. It's so good to see you again.
Ah, lovely to see you too.
I've never seen you this starstruck. It's not about me, but it's about our previous guest.
Yeah, Greil Marcus. Wow. Wow, no, my legs are actually shaking. I'm just such a huge fan, and you don't expect to meet him at a threshold.
No, you don't.
You know? And thank heavens he was holding his book, because it was like a little nice badge. So, but it's lovely to see you too.
It's been a long time, but we should talk about films now that we have this 6-7 minutes for that. So what kind of a film week has it been? What do you think?
It's a really good film week, actually. It's packed with... It's the kind of week... Now, you're aware that distributors plan where they're gonna release their films, and it's important what they go against. depending on what they're going to see. So this week, there's a lot of kind of strong but quirky films, and there's first-time directors. For example, we've got 71, which is by a first-time director, Yann Demange, I think I've got his name wrong. He's normally just does television and shorts, but he's made a really powerful film about the Irish Troubles, and that stars O'Connell, Jack O'Connell, who's very, very strong and starred up. So people are talking about that. They're also talking about Maze Runner, which is the post-apocalyptic youth. It's sort of like Hunger Games kind of thing. It's the first in a franchise. But there's only two maze scenes in it, only two maze running scenes. So if you're into maze running, you're going to be disappointed. But it's very entertaining, and it's quite good. But the ones that I really want to talk about were two very different films, and one is Charlie's Country, and the other is The Calling.
Let's start with Charlie's Country, and let's listen to what it sounds like.
G'day, Luke.
G'day, Charlie.
You white bastard.
You black bastard.
You
got a license?
License? We're not going to drive you. We're just going to shoot him.
Morning. Do you know where the witch is? Car. Morning, morning.
I assume quite a few listeners are trying to figure out what the film is all about. Oh. And what I can say is that it's probably located in Australia.
Yes, it is. The next 19 questions are... Actually, this... Okay, if you've ever seen a film called Walkabout from 1971, Nick Rogue, there was a man called David Goupilil, and I'm not sure I'm saying his name right, who was the Aborigine man in that, and he was wonderful. Now, he's also in this as an old man, an older man. Still, I mean, this man, David Goupilil, grew up in the bush. He did not grow up being affected by Western culture. He's a native dancer and an actor. He's very gifted singer. And he's had a very long career representing Australia, traveling around the world. He's an artist. This is, I think, the third film, I could be wrong with this, that he's made with Dutch director Rolf de Heer, who's in fact in London right now with the festival. And this is a wonderful modern story. I say wonderful because it's poignant and it's entertaining. And there are a lot of long still shots of this man, David Goupilil. You just can't take your eyes off of him. It's just a lovely, touching film. And it's also Australia's entry for the Oscars. Hasn't been nominated yet, but it's what the country offers. And it's interesting, if you're interested in any sort of native stuff, there's also a film called The Deadlands, which is New Zealand's entry for the Oscar.
That sounds amazing. I think we should continue this game, please. By the way. Let's listen to another trailer and let's try to figure out what it's all about.
Father Price, could you tell me what that means?
Is a prayer of resurrection. This prayer has been lost for 1,500 years.
I think somebody may have found it.
Drink this, and all your suffering will be gone.
Look at that.
It's how he's recruiting them.
Stand down, Wicked! No!
Hello, Hazel.
Who is this?
Well, you know who it is.
It sounds like there is more action in this film than in the previous one. This was The Calling.
Well, you can't compare them, really. Drink this and all your suffering will be gone. Haven't you heard that every weekend?
I have.
Okay, this film is really getting knocked really hard, and I think it's a bit unfair. It starts out, the first half starts out as Susan Sarandon basically playing Fargo. She's stuck in this, you know, wintry cold. She's a police officer. She lives with her mother, who's Ellen Burstyn, who's absolutely lovely. And she doesn't, they don't like each other. Susan Sarandon's got a drinking problem, of course. But she's a very skillful policewoman. Now, I went into this, normally I don't know anything about the movies when I go to see them, which is not the way I should do it. I know I should read up. I wanted to think, this is great. This is because she's pulling off one of these Bruce Dern sort of Richard Gere things. It's a small film and there's going to be a big star in it and it's going to be great acting. And then it turns into Seven, basically, David Fincher's Seven, where people are getting their heads almost slit off and we don't know what's going on. And it turns out that there's a religious element, and that's where Donald Sutherland comes in.
And you like it, the film?
It wasn't so bad.
Excellent. Thank you very much. That was film critic Karen Krzyzanowicz in the studio. And that's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Jim Hoare and Jane Kinnamond, and Karen, of course, as well. Today's show was produced by Daniela Ciacopelli, researched by David Pleasant and Muriel Awaji. Our studio manager was Joel Church. Next, after the headlines, is The Menu, our weekly food and drink show, hosted by yours truly. Then at 2200 hours London time, it's The Monocle Daily with Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson. Make sure to tune in Tuesday and Wednesday next week, where we'll be broadcasting live at London's largest art fair, Frieze. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye.
From London
to Beijing,
this is Monocle 24.
Nach Amsterdam,
a Bogota,
to Hong Kong,
all around the world.
This is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.